This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Professor H.J. Mackinder, International Relations, to comment on developments in the war in Europe. The headline from the Washington Post: Sweden's ruling party greenlights joining NATO. Bloc chief calls potential ads historic. Subhead: Sweden's ruling party greenlights. Subhead: NATO chief says addition of Sweden and Finland historic moment. Subhead: Finland formally announces NATO membership bid. Professor, the alliance that was defensive in the first Cold War now looks like an assembly of Napoleon's army ready to invade Mother Russia. But there's more. Not only is NATO well-armed and sending more and more weapons and money into the ongoing war in Europe, but it's joined by powers such as Japan, such as Australia, such as parts of the Asian continent that did not play a part in the European War of the 1910s and 1940s. We're looking at an overwhelming alliance. It's nuclear armed. It's got a fleet that dwarfs anything that the Russians can provide. And even if you put the Russians together with the Chinese, we're not looking at a substantive entente. We're looking at defensive play. Certainly the Russian performance in Ukraine weighs on the minds of the men in Beijing, which is why suddenly they're getting what you'd have to say was nervous. So, Professor, NATO is very strong. My reading of history is war comes when one side thinks that it's going to lose if it waits. That was certainly the case in 1914. Is NATO so strong it's going to invite bad action from Beijing and Moscow? Good evening to you.
Good evening. Well, I think this is a very fundamental question, because the way that we keep peace on the Eurasian world island is by having balance. And right now, the balance of military power is really concentrated on the western extremity. I mean, Ukraine in 1600 was really not part of Russia. It was not really part of Russia at all. It was part of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, of which a few people were there, but it was really part of Europe. I think the problem that Russia faces is that if she should decide that this is a quasi-Napoleonic alliance prepared to invade Russia, then she is going to find herself committing even more of her forces to her western frontier than she has already. The percentage of the Russian military that is already in Ukraine is very, very large, and it's very unbalanced. And if they decide that they're going to deal with Sweden and Finland, they're going to move even more. What we'll see, I think, in the course of our discussion today is that Russia faces problems on her other side, on her Kazakhstan, on her China side, and she also faces problems to her south, with the question of her relationship to India, and to her west, her relationship, and to her south, rather, the relationship with China. So if I were a Russian, and I'm not, and I don't understand how Mr. Putin thinks, I would say this is a time to keep some powder dry, because we don't know what's going to happen. And therefore, unless NATO is crazy, we're going to have the sense to realize that Ukraine, given all of this tremendous support she has, they're going to be able to defeat Russia within the bounds of the Ukrainian state that Russia herself recognized, that the UN recognizes, the legal Russian state. And that is a good outcome, because that means that international law and so forth is kept. And what we must be sure to do is to be satisfied with that and make it secure, and then help to restore the balance. because if we have a balanced peace, if we have a peace that has a balance, that's homeostatic, as it were, then the countries in particularly the eastern part of Europe will not fear war. But if we end up with a sort of patched together peace that doesn't resolve this basic issue of balance, then there will simply be another war. So I think that what we're shifting to, we should be thinking about war termination and how to do something that we didn't manage very well in World War II, and we somehow did a little bit better in World War One, I mean, and we did better in World War II, but that we had to put together a stable peace.
The conditions are deteriorating, Professor. I read from the Financial Times. Russia's invasion is raising the risk of a global hunger crisis. The G7 group of industrialized nations is urgently seeking alternative routes to export Ukrainian grain, currently being blockaded by Russian forces. Wheat prices have soared in recent weeks because of supply concerns and droughts around the world, exacerbated by India's recent ban on wheat exports. Famine does not make for good negotiations, nor does it lead countries to reasonable conclusions. What we have right now are the conditions that, to my reading, Professor, suggest that Russia and China will move, and they will move aggressively because if they wait, they will also suffer the famine and the deracination that follows from famine. You have already evidenced in our previous conversations that the leadership in Beijing is uncertain. We have already observed the headlines from London that Vladimir Putin, the all-powerful Vladimir Putin, is either ill or said to be ill by the people he is now surrounded with, some of whom are under arrest. Those are unstable conditions. That doesn't lead to a negotiation and reason.
Well, I think that's correct. That's one of the reasons that I'm very concerned. I fear that this is a time for, as you often put it, American leadership. We have to help to lead the world to a reordering. We have to do something about this Russian blockade that is preventing the export of Ukrainian wheat. We have to find out what the situation with food is in China, and so forth and so on. We, the Americans, this is where we come in the two previous versions of this play, in World War One and World War Two. What I fear is that we just don't have the cast. We don't have the ability to take over war termination with a firm, experienced and hand, and with a degree of credibility that all share, that all believe in. So I'm pessimistic. I think that it's really going to be up to us to see these big issues that you describe and to address them. But I'm not optimistic that we're going to. After all, we have the leaders of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations gathering together in Washington in an almost unprecedented meeting. And all they had 2 hours with the president. They had no bilateral talks with the president, and they had dinner, and Nancy Pelosi was sitting at the next table talking to them. Well, as I think Michelin would say, it wasn't worth the trip. This was an example, because Blinken, who should have been handling the whole thing, was in Europe. Now, we've got to be able to coordinate enough so that we don't have two major meetings, really, really major, major meetings on the same day. But this sort of evidence is very worrying.
And, Professor, I mentioned that the World Island depends a deal on China's stability. And China right now is going through a an unprecedented lockdown. We've not seen anything like this on the face of the earth. The last time we had an accounting was 340 million were in some form of lockdown, and there's no indication that it's lifted. That makes the alliance with Russia even more unstable. So, in addition to famine, in addition to war in Europe, in addition to the illness of Vladimir Putin, we have what appears to be China destroying the economy that it's taken 30 years to build. Or am I misunderstanding what China's doing?
No, I think if anything, you haven't grasped the enormity of it. As of now, telephone connections to the outside world have been stopped. People are not being able to leave. When they go to the airport, their passports are confiscated. And the lockdown of the economy is the lockdown, which is in pursuit of a medically unsound approach to dealing with COVID. Everybody agrees it's medically unsound, including the Chinese doctors who know, it's thought that if it goes on for 3 or 4 more weeks, the economy may collapse. And commentators in China are talking about really the loss of all that China has gained since we began putting $3 trillion in there in the 70s. Now, you said, I think you said something about the man in Peking. I should point out that the man in Peking is right now harboring in the southwest in the second tier province of Guangxi, where he apparently can keep everything under control. But within the party, there is an internecine war going on. That is as they might say in their language, it's I live, you die. China is in a state of complete disarray. One Chinese commentator described it as a complete crisis. So I'm not even sure that we grasp that. But there's certainly the idea of coordinated activity between Russia and China, I think, is off the table for now.
Professor H.J. Mackinder, International Relations, commenting on the state of affairs in the world island, the sweeping world island. When we come back, the professor has thoughts about India, which is the rising power of the world island. And so far, it's been chastised by the United States and its allies for not voting to condemn Russia at the United Nations. I just noted the report where India has stopped exporting wheat because of its concerns over the famine. And India has a working relationship with Moscow because of its weapon systems, because of its history. So when we come back, is India a road forward or a wild card? This is Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.